welcome to Comic Talk Today for Monday, September 10th, 2018. And this is the episode of the week I like to call The Top of the Pile. Of course, The Top of the Pile, I look back at some of my favorite reads from this past week, and I don't have as many as I usually do. In fact, I think I'm going to try to cut down a little bit. I think I'm going to try to do about 5 or 6 a week. Hopefully that works out. I don't know. But that is what I have today. I'll be talking about 6 books. This week, I've got 2 from Marvel Comics, 1 from Image, 1 from DC Vertigo, and 1 from DC Jinx World. Well, maybe 2 from DC Jinx World. Of course, stay tuned to the end of the episode, in which I'll talk about some of my recommendations for this week's new comic book day. And this week, I'm going to warn you, it's going to be a packed week. I actually have a surgery planned for tomorrow, so I'll be home most of the rest of the week, which means I'll be recording episodes pretty much for every day this week. We'll be doing the news tomorrow. Wednesday, I've got a rant. Thursday, I may do another rant. Friday will be our Therapy Thursday. I know I'm confusing you guys lately. Matt Miner is going to be on the show, and he's got a new book out called Poser, which is fantastic. I'll be talking to him about that and some of his other projects. Then Saturday, we'll be having another Secret Origins, in which I'll be doing the Secret Origin of Martian Manhunter. And I know you guys are really digging the Secret Origin thing, so I may start doing those every week or so. I don't know. I haven't decided yet. Without further ado, it's time to talk about some of these books on The Top of the Pile. First up is going to be As Guardians of the Galaxy number 1 from Marvel Comics. This is, of course, written by Cullen Bunn, art by Matteo Loli and Federico Bli. And this is actually really interesting. I love the pun of the name, by the way, because, of course, if you could imagine, every single member of this team is an Asgardian. Heading up the team is Angela, which I find really fascinating, by the way. I think I talked about this when this book was first announced. I had Cullen on a few weeks ago. Matter of fact, I think I had Cullen on the week that the book was announced, or maybe the week after the book was announced. I've been eagerly anticipating this one. And the reason I found it so fascinating is that he's using Angela as the lead of the team. And of course, those of you that have been around comics for a long time will remember Angela from Spawn number 9 all the way back in like 93, 94, I want to say. Pretty early on, it was an issue written by Neil Gaiman with art by Todd McFarlane, and it was absolutely brilliant. And Angela was a huge part of Spawn until there was this whole legal battle, and Gaiman took the character away. Marvel ended up somehow acquiring the character through some crazy deals. You know how the comic industry is. And so they, you know, she's been kind of retconned into Asgardian history as a sibling of Thor and Loki. And that does come up in this issue, of course. But everyone in the team is an Asgardian. We've got Scourge. Of course, Angela's the lead of the team. We've got the Destroyer. Valkyrie is in here. Thunderstrike, which I found really interesting. I remember going back to old 90s comics. Do you remember reading the Thunderstrike comic? I remember reading Thunderstrike. He was actually a pretty interesting character back then. I didn't recognize him at first when I saw him in here. You know, when I read the caption, I was like, wait, that's Thunderstrike? He looks very different. And I don't know if I haven't been paying attention or what it is. If he's appeared in the Thor book, then I totally missed him for whatever reason. Or maybe I'm not paying enough attention when I read these books. Who knows? But he looks very, very different. In fact, I would say the Thor look now reminds me a lot of what Thunderstrike used to look back in, like, what year was that? That had to be like same year, right? Like 93, 94. Anyways, Thunderstrike is in this book. He's got an interesting non-Asgardian looking costume. And, of course, the second best Thor of all time, Throg the Frog, is in here. Yes, you heard me correctly. There's a frog on the Asgardians team. I thought it was fantastic, by the way. Now, what exactly is the big event that this team is being put together to kind of stop is kind of not really explained very well, I gotta say. I think it could have been done a little bit better. From what I can gather, they're trying to stop some kind of mysterious force that's trying to bring Ragnarok back. And as we learn in the book itself, it is Nebula, Thanos' granddaughter. And I thought that was really interesting because there's a reference in here to Infinity Wars, which is, of course, going on right now at Marvel Comics. And that series is actually pretty good. So there's a little bit of a tie-in there. I find that pretty interesting. But I like this kind of crazy team. And I think that's what's most interesting about this book is how this team is being assembled. And we don't really see a lot of it, by the way. by the time we actually get into the action, most of the team has already been formed aside from Valkyrie. She does get recruited pretty early on in the beginning by Angela and the Destroyer. And, that whole thing is pretty interesting. Of course, she's being used because her human persona that she's inhabiting is an archaeologist, and they have runes to decipher. And there's even a joke on there that I really liked, because they bring her in to decipher these runes, and, you know, really the Asgardians are just all about fighting, right? And pretty much this book has a ton of that. There's a lot of action in the book. They're constantly fighting trolls and giants and all kinds of different beings. And at one point, she's trying to decipher some runes, and they almost destroy what she's trying to decipher. And she's like, guys, you're Asgardians. You don't even know, like, your history. That's why you have me here to decipher the runes. I thought that was really interesting. And pretty typical, right? Because usually when I think of Asgardians, I usually think of these noble warriors that are just out to battle and save the universe. But they don't really maybe oftentimes think about what they're doing. They just go and act. And this team is very much about acting. Now, of course, all of it takes place in space. That's why it's called the Asgardians of the Galaxy. And there's a nice little twist at the end, which I really enjoyed. The Destroyer may or may not be who he appears to be. Okay, there, I spoiled it. He's not who he appears to be. It's actually somebody else. And I'm not going to spoil who it actually is. It's a character that kind of hasn't been around in a little while. I believe he was killed a couple of years ago, and it seems like the character's back. So that should prove pretty interesting. But I think overall there was a nice setup on this book. I really enjoyed it. In fact, I would say this was kind of my fun read of the week. It's definitely not as deep as some of the other books that I'll be talking about tonight, but it was a lot of fun to read, and I really enjoyed it. I'm definitely going to be sticking around with Asgardians of the Galaxy, and I want to see what Cullen Bunn's got with this. You know, I'm used to reading his horror stuff. It's the stuff that I love reading from him, but you know, he does do a lot of superhero stuff, and this one was really fantastic. So Asgardians of the Galaxy is going to be a 4 out of 5. On to the next Marvel book is going to be Death of the Inhumans number 3. I almost said number 1. Written by Donny Cates, with art by Ariel Olivetti, colors by Jordi Belair, and letters by Clayton Cowles. And, of course, I've been loving every single issue of this book. You know, I was a little worried at first when they said Death of the Inhumans, although really it was to be expected, right? One thing that I was thinking about is, you know, that show tanked so badly. I wonder if all of this stuff would be happening if the show hadn't tanked, right? Because think about it. If Disney is going to be owning the X-Men again, right? That's maybe part of the emphasis on the X titles right now, why they're bringing Uncanny back, for example. If Disney is focusing so much on the X-Men, what would have happened to the Inhumans had that TV show on ABC not tanked? By the way, I never finished that show, which is really a shame, because I spent 6 hours of my life watching the first 6 episodes, and I never finished the last 2. So if you actually ended up finishing the show, I'm curious to know what your thoughts are. Maybe by the end of the week, I'll catch up and watch those final 2. I just didn't care to. I really lost interest in the TV series, and it seems like most people did as well. So anyways, as you may, of course, know by listening to the show, you know that I'm a huge Donny Cates fan, and I think he's doing something really special with this book. In particular, this issue I found really interesting is because we have a change in Black Bolt's power set a little bit, and maybe it's not really a change in the power set, but kind of a change in the way that it's used. So the big bad, the villain of this book, is Vox. And he's a faceless Kree warrior who may or may not also be an Inhuman. And of course, if you know a little bit of Latin or maybe understand Greek and Latin roots, you'll understand that Vox is the word that we get the word voice from. So of course, he would be the nemesis to Black Bolt, who can't speak. This guy is Vox. He actually talks quite a bit, and it's a little bit annoying. But they've captured, at the end of the second issue, they captured Black Bolt, and now they've performed surgery on him in order to stop him from using his powers, which makes perfect sense, right? In fact, the couple panels where they show that, they show them sewing his throat back together. I thought that was... it was pretty gruesome to see, right? Because you see, like, the little bits of meat hanging out. It's just like, ugh, that's kind of gross. But kind of something that I expect out of Donny Cates. He definitely likes to inject horror elements into the books. Well, what they didn't think of is that Black Bolt's abilities are so powerful that even through this surgery that should technically impair his use of his abilities, he is still able to use them. And not to the same extent, right? So we're used to Black Bolt using sign language, because even just whispering something can just totally destroy anything that's in front of him. Well, the surgery has kind of taken that away from him, but he can still use his abilities. In fact, after the surgery, they just kind of let him loose, and they're like, you know, if he was actually any threat to us, he would have screamed during the surgery. We didn't give him any painkillers or anything, because we're total a-holes. And, you know, he didn't say anything. So, obviously, it's working, right? He can't speak. Well, as some of the guards find out, he actually can speak. And the guards are kind of poking fun at him, some of the Kree guards. They're poking fun at him. They're like, hey, old little Black Bolt, like, you're not so powerful now, are you? And he starts whispering the names of Inhumans that have been killed in the process of this miniseries. And, of course, like, their noses start bleeding. They start getting massive headaches. And, yeah, it works out in his favor. There's some other interesting things in here as well. For example, we see the return of Ronan the Accuser, which I found really interesting. And what was interesting about it was he's very different than what we've seen before. And he's used kind of as a way to explain what these Kree are trying to accomplish. And it seems like they may not necessarily be the Kree that we're used to, which kind of makes a lot of sense. He calls them heretics. And it seems like they came and they tried to destroy the Supreme Intelligence. And, you know, anybody that doesn't want to join them, they're just killing or incapacitating. And they're only keeping the strong in order to help them with their battle. And Ronan explains all this. And what was really touching is that Ronan kind of, he does apologize to Black Bolt for all the trouble that he's caused him over the years. And I thought that was so interesting. Something that I wouldn't see Ronan actually do. So I really like that part of the book as well. One of my favorite things about this, and it almost made this my pick of the week this week, is the last page or so. So as all this stuff is happening at this Kree station where they're holding Black Bolt, we do have Medusa and the surviving Inhumans trying to find allies around the galaxy to try to stop these guys and get Black Bolt back. And they're like, yeah, we should go to this place and get this guy. And they never mentioned by name. So, you know, it's going to be some kind of revelation at the end. And, when this character showed up, I was just like, hell yes. Because while Throg may be the second best Thor, the greatest Thor of all time is, of course, Beta Ray Bill. So Beta Ray Bill shows up at the end and he's being enlisted by Medusa to find Black Bolt. And the way that they entice him to come is Lockjaw. He's like, I don't want any part in anybody's war or anything like that. I just want to relax in my, you know, little place and just have a good time, not fight, not be in any battles all the time. And Crystal's like, look, you know, these guys came in, they killed all our family, they killed Lockjaw. And he's like, wait, they killed Lockjaw? I'm in. And I was like, yes, Beta Ray Bill, you are the best. Why don't you have your own book? So I'm really excited for the rest of this, now that Beta Ray Bill is in here. And I know some of you are laughing. You're like, Beta Ray Bill, he's so ridiculous. And you're right, but that's exactly why I love him. He's so ridiculous, but he does not give a crap, and I think that's why he's awesome. So I really enjoyed Death of the Inhumans number 3. I think this is definitely a series worth picking up. It's somewhat away from the rest of the Marvel Universe, which is also nice, right? Even though a lot of it does take place in space, so you could have some cosmic elements popping in, none of that actually happens. And I like that. I like that it's self-contained. So Death of the Inhumans number 3 is going to be a 4 out of 5. Let's go on over to, I said this was an Image book. It's a Vertigo book. That's right, because this week, or this past week, was the relaunch of the Vertigo line over for DC. And so the first one I want to talk about is going to be Border Town from DC Vertigo. This is written by Eric Esquivel with art by Ramon Villalobos and colors by Tamer Van Villen. And boy, was this really interesting. It definitely took me by surprise. I did get to read this a little while back and I had totally forgotten about it, but I do remember enjoying it. And I often like to reread books after a little while, especially ones that try to do something a little different in the way that they tell stories. And Border Town is one of those books that is definitely very interesting. This will definitely not appeal to a certain demographic of comic readers. And by that I mean maybe somebody more on the conservative side. But, you know, even if you're more on the conservative side, I do recommend reading this book because it does bring up some really interesting, topics. And the way that it does it is very creative. And I really enjoy that, right? So I often talk about books that, try to bring in politics and current events into stories. And I understand that there are many of you that don't care for that stuff. And I think that's totally fine. You know, that one of the great pleasures that we have is that we are able to read whatever the hell we want, right? And I totally understand that. What I don't understand is, of course, when we don't want to read a particular thing and we tell everyone else that they suck for wanting to read it. That, I don't think that's the right attitude. But by all means, if you don't want to read something, don't read it. With that said, this is really interesting. So, of course, the creative team is mostly Hispanic, right? I believe Esquivel is Mexican. And so a lot of the mythology around this new series, Border Town, does have ties to Mexican mythology. And it plays in even stronger once you get to the end of the book. And basically it takes place in Devil's Fork, Arizona. We do see some of the racial tensions in this town, right? We get a little bit of history about Arizona, how, you know, they didn't implement Martin Luther King Day. Like, they were the last state in the Union to do so. We learn a little bit about, you know, neo-Nazi groups in the area. We learn about, you know, whites against immigrants. We learn about illegal immigration because, of course, it's a border town, hence the name. And the name actually has a double meaning. And I'll get to that in a little bit as well. But it was really interesting. And so, of course, most of the characters in this book are high school kids. Most of the book does take place in a high school. And that does lead to some interesting ways to bring in some of these different topics into the story with a little bit of imagination. So most of the book centers around one character who just moved into Devil's Fork. And, you know, of course, being the new kid in high school, people are interested, right? They're like, who's this new kid? Let's find out everything about him. And, we learned that, you know, maybe one of the bullies kind of likes the kid for some reason. There's a neo-Nazi that likes him because he's a new kid and like maybe they can enlist him. And that leads into other things because in class, as he's talking to some girls that are really interesting to know a little bit more about him, they're like, well, are you a neo-Nazi? Cause you pounded that one guy. And he's like, he's a neo-Nazi. He's like, he's got terrible fashion sense. And, they're like, yeah, you couldn't tell he's a skinhead. So he's like, well, there's no way I'm a white power guy, right? Like, I love anime and, you know, I follow Japanese creators on Twitter and, you know, I'm half Mexican. And he like yells that in class. And so, of course, this gets around to the school, this whole showing because, you know, the new kid's showing out on the first day. And, this neo-Nazi guy finds out and he's like, you tricked me. Or he's like, you lied to me. And the kid's like, I didn't lie to you. I didn't even know you. I didn't talk to you. All you came off and said, hey, and gave me a pound. And the kid's like, we're going to meet outside the Jack in the Box after school and we're going to fight. And the kid's like, all right, that's fine, whatever. And he's like, does anybody know where it is? Can somebody take me there? So he goes to the Jack in the Box, and they start fighting. And, of course, he kind of shows off that part of the reason he's here is because he had issues with his temper at his previous school and broke a kid's nose. So he ends up doing the same with this one kid who ends up threatening him with a gun. And the cops show up. But the cop isn't really a cop. He's a monster. And the little bully guy is there, but he's kind of like a hulky. He's like literally the Hulk in a wrestling mask. I thought that was really interesting. So it's really creative, really inventive. It tries to bring in some of these, political statements into the book, somehow tying him into Mexican mythology. So you kind of like wondering, well, is the cop actually a monster? Or is that just how the kids see him? And I think that's also a really interesting way to look at it. And you don't really know until the end of the book, because one of these monsters that's been kind of hanging around that attacks him ends up turning into this little lizard-looking thing and runs to the border fence between Mexico and the United States, right? Hence Border Town. And as he's getting to the fence, he like swipes up, like literally not on a phone. He swipes up with his hand and a portal opens and he goes through the portal and shows up in the Aztec underworld. So like an alternate dimension. And we get to, of course, meet the ruler god of this underworld, the Aztec god of the underworld. And we learned that the little monster thing was a chupacabra. So I thought the whole thing was fascinating, right? Cause it almost doesn't make sense, right? And a lot of the times you're wondering like, well, is this just like a YA thing, right? Where you're trying to use allegories for certain things in a visual way. And sure, that is partially the case, but, you know, this stuff is actually happening. And, apparently we'll be seeing a lot more of that as the series progresses. But I thought it was, really brilliantly done. The art is really fantastic as well. I think a lot of that has to do with the coloring. And, yeah, I thought it was a brilliant, brilliant book. If you want to try something new and different and creative and don't mind seeing some of that, you know, political stuff, social stuff, then, I definitely recommend this book. It was, I thought it was something special, something different, and I like seeing different, right? I don't always have to agree with political views or anything like that of a creator, but even through that, I think, it does bring up some interesting topics in a new and different way. So I think this was well worth it. It's going to be a 5 out of 5 for me. Also from DC Vertigo is going to be The Dreaming number 1, written by Simon Spurrier with art by Bilquis Evely and colors by Matt Lopez. And let me just say off the bat, Bilquis Evely is a brilliant, brilliant artist. She is fantastic. I love her. Love her. I think she's a perfect choice for this book. All right. With that said, I have some issues with the writing of this book, and I think most of it goes away pretty quickly. I would say the first, I don't know, maybe 5 or 6 pages kind of had me not really wanting to continue with the book. I think one of the things is it's been so long since I've been engrossed in the Sandman universe, right? With the Dreaming and all that stuff. And sure, we had the Sandman universe one shot a couple weeks ago, and it was really good. It was a nice introduction, but you know, it takes a little bit of time to get readjusted to these characters, in particular because there's a lot of weirdness happening, right? I mean, the book is called The Dreaming because it takes place in the Dreaming, right? It's like an alternate dimension, dream world, fantasy, mythological place. It's not really a tactile place. It lives in allegory and metaphor. And so it's kind of hard to figure those things out. And there's a large cast of characters. Well, not large, but, you know, large-ish. And so there's a lot to have to remember. And I didn't. And as a result, I wondered when I was reading this, and that might also be part of the problem I had in the first few pages. The problem I had was, well, if I am having these issues, and I have read all of Sandman, and I've read The Dreaming, and Fables, and all that stuff, I wonder how a new reader would feel to this book, right? And, you know, I often talk about the whole, you know, should every book be somebody's first book? And I'm going to be talking about that this week. I was going to put out an episode this weekend, and I totally didn't have time, so it'll be out sometime this week. But it kind of deals with, you know, how to figure out what it is that you like in the comics that you like and how to branch out beyond that. And one of the things that I talk about is this very thing. And I've mentioned it in many podcasts, on this podcast, on Narnia Legion and a few other ones, how, you know, Stan Lee always had that thing where every comic book issue should be somebody's, should be approachable enough for every new reader. And that's not always feasible, and nor do I feel like it's realistic. So I don't agree with it entirely. But I think at least for a number one issue of characters that we haven't seen in several years, it really would make sense to explain a little bit more about what's going on, right? Because there's a lot of references in here, for example, to Dream. And Dream is not in this book. I'm sure he will be at some point, but he's not in this book. And there's a lot of reference to him not being there. Not, you know, they call him the Master sometimes. Sometimes they call him Dream. And you know, you're wondering like, well, who is the Master? Why is this Dream guy so important? And maybe that's kind of answer to the end of the issue, but not really. And you're kind of left wondering, right? So I wonder how a new reader to this would feel, right? Because this universe is really not easy to read anyway, right? There's so much history and backstory to all these characters that it can be a daunting task. And so I'm not sure if a new reader is necessarily the audience for Sandman. And I talked about that when this book was first announced, because I wondered what the audience was. And I mean, I would assume the audience is whoever was reading Sandman, but is that a large enough audience to warrant this book continuing, in particular when there's four books out, right? And there's another one coming out this week. And I'm not sure that's the case. I guess we'll see in time how these books are doing, but that does have me a little worried. With that said, once we get in about 5 or 6 pages, I think the book does get pretty interesting and a little more engrossing. And I think a lot of that has to do with the book kind of turning, Dora as the central character. And Dora is, if you picked up this book, the character on the cover, it's the girl with the wings coming out of her head. And she's really interesting. And of course she's very upset because Dream is no longer around, and Dream is the one that brought her into the dreaming and kind of kept her safe and away from all her issues that she had in her life. And you know, some of the other characters in the dreaming don't really know what to think of her, don't really like her, because she's got the interesting ability of being able to hop between different people's dreams and hop between realities and dimensions. And maybe they're a little jealous of that, or maybe they feel like that's, you know, kind of against what the dreaming should be about. And so they don't really like her. And so, you know, she feels like an outcast. And in this book, she's going around stealing stuff from different people's dreams. And as we learn, she was giving it to Balzum, I think is the character's name, one of the Dukes of Hell. And they do end up having sex in the book, by the way. There's no nudity, but you definitely see them having sex. And they talk about it quite a bit. And the demon guy wants to do it again. And she's like, look, can I just get my stuff? That whole thing was really interesting. I think Dora is a fascinating character. I hope it's not just a teenage angsty thing for a large chunk of the series. I think that'll get boring really fast if that's the case. But I really enjoyed what I saw. Well, after Dora and Balzum have sex, she's heading back to her world, and she drops a piece of the fruit that he gave her as a prize for bringing him all the stuff. He goes to pick it up. She's like, oh, you can't pick that up because, you know, you can only come into the dreaming if you're invited. Well, he reaches through the portal and is able to grab the fruit. And he's like, oh, well, I can get into the dreaming. Let me go in there. So he jumps into the dreaming and starts fighting this dragon and meets up with Eve. Yes, that Eve from Adam and Eve meets up with Eve. And we see that Dream not being in the dreaming is causing a lot of issues. And all the safeguards, the precautions that Dream has put in place for evil entities to enter the dreaming are kind of failing. And, you know, nobody really knows what to do. So Lucien, who is kind of the librarian of the dreaming, he's been talking to Dream's mask the whole time. He ends up putting on a white robe and a mask. And you don't know this initially, but you find out pretty quickly. And pretends to be Dream come back from his adventure, whatever that is. Nobody knows what that is, right? He pretends to be Dream, and this demon's like, oh, Dream, you're back. Like, oh, my bad. I didn't mean to come into the dreaming. Let me get out of here before you destroy me. And he talks to some of the other people in the dreaming to kind of make them feel better, right? Because they all feel a little lost, and they're not sure why Dream isn't there. And you know, of course, Lucien is trying to find out exactly why he's not there. But he feels like maybe this is the best course of action in order to appease everybody. And it seems to work, so maybe he was right. But there's some other interesting nefarious things going on in the dreaming. And I'm sure we'll get to know a little bit more about that as the book progresses. So overall, I really enjoyed it. Like I said, if this is your first time coming into this universe and you pick up the book, let me know what you thought, because I'm really curious. I feel like this is really one of those things where, coming in with a blank slate may not be the best idea, but I could be totally wrong. I really enjoyed it though. I think it could have been better in some respects, but for first issue is really quite enjoyable. And I think if the book keeps up this pace, I could see progressing where in a few issues, it really feels like something deep and magical, right? Like the original books did. So overall, 4 out of 5 for me on this one. Let's move on over to the final two. And I'm going to talk about one in length and one really briefly. The one I talk about briefly is cover number one from DC Jinx World, written by Brian Michael Bendis with art by David Mack. And the reason I want to talk about it briefly is that I really, really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed it. I didn't love it, but I really enjoyed it. I thought it was really well done. However, I didn't feel like there was enough in there to catch me, right? And this is another one of those really slow builds as well. Basically, it follows a comic book artist who meets this fan who buys a bunch of art from him. And it turns out that this fan is a CIA analyst. And she may be enlisting him to join the CIA. I mean, I don't know. That's the way it seems. When I read the synopsis last week, that's also the way it seemed. So maybe that is what the book is about. But you don't really get that feeling from this book because, again, there's a lot of setup. And having read this, I do wonder how much of this book is kind of like Bendis trying to say something about the comic book industry, because there's a lot of that. I would say the first like third of the book, a lot of it happens in, I want to say, flashback scenes. I'm not quite sure. I think they're flashback scenes because they're being narrated. They happen in flashback scenes at a convention, and you can kind of tell where in time you are based on the art of this book. So the artist, David Mack, whom I absolutely love. However, a lot of it doesn't feel like David Mack because it's very, very toned down and it's very simple art. All the scenes that happen at comic book conventions are done in almost like a blue pencil. So it almost appears a little ghostly, and the characters aren't sketched very well. It's literally like the sketching phases of a book, right? Where the panels aren't really like perfectly straight lines, the characters aren't like clearly defined. It would be like if you're doing an outline of a character. Well, a little more than that. But it's done on purpose. And I think it's a little jarring at first if you're used to a lot of the Big Two, or even some of the other comic book companies, where you have like really top-notch artists who spend like, you know, a week on a page. Hopefully not that long, really, because then they'll never release the book. But who spend a lot of time, right? A lot of these guys are spending like an entire day, you know, 10, 12, 14 hours a day on one page. One page. And so, of course, the art is going to be extremely detailed and crisp. And that's not the case for much of this book. The other art style that is in here is something that I think David Mack is more well known for, and that's the painted stuff that he does. And in fact, there's a little bit of a DC David Mack art cover art gallery at the end of the book. You know, Bendis likes to throw in some back matter into this, which I really like. All the Jinx World books have had that so far. I hope they do a lot more of it, by the way, because I think that stuff is fascinating. This one, maybe not as much as some of the other ones, right? Because in the other ones, we had like a short story and some other stuff. This one was just covers. But I like that he's doing this kind of thing where he's explaining kind of to the reader, you know, this book isn't just Brian Michael Bendis. It's Brian Michael Bendis and, you know, whoever. David Mack, for example, in this book. I like that kind of thing. Because it shows that comics aren't just about the one person, right? I mean, you may usually only know who the writer and the artist is. And then some of you may know who the colorist is, but what about that, like after that, right? A lot of you guys don't care who the inker is or who the letterer is, who edits a book. And I think, you know, he's trying to say, like, this is a joint effort, right? Anyways, there's a lot going on in here, talking about comic convention culture and how creators deal with each other at conventions. There's a lot of in-jokes in here, which I really enjoyed. There's a lot of, you know, crazy fans. There's a lot of cosplay jokes in here. I really enjoyed all that stuff. But ultimately, I don't know how it ties in directly to the overall story. Although it kind of does, right? Because this guy's day job is being a comic book artist. And he seems to be a pretty successful comic book artist. I don't know if he's, you know, a giant name. But he definitely has stuff that people follow. And at one of these conventions, he meets this girl. He's like, yeah, I have prints over here, and here's original art. And of course, just like always, he expects her to buy prints. Because usually that's what happens at conventions, right? You can get a print for, you know, 10, 15, 20 bucks. You can get original art for hundreds or thousands of dollars. And she's like, yeah, I like this cover. I'll buy the original. He's like, okay. He's like, she's like, well, didn't you work on this other book, like Ninja something? I can't remember what it is. He's like, yeah, that was me. She's like, oh, I love that. He's like, really? He's like, I have this page here. She's like, yeah, I'll buy that too. And I'll buy this other original art and this other one. And he's like, you do know that they're like 800 bucks a piece, right? She's like, yeah, I love them. He's like, how much for all of them? And he's like, well, $2,000. She's like, don't sell yourself short. You're an artist. Like, get paid for your work. I like that kind of thing too, right? It's another little thing in here that Bendis is throwing in. And so she pays full price for everything, 800 bucks a piece, and ends up meeting him at another convention overseas. And She's like, yeah, I just came because I knew you were here. And he's like, what do you do exactly? And she's like, I'm an analyst at Langley. He's like, Langley? She's like, yeah, like CIA Langley. And, I thought the whole thing was interesting. So she was there, like, shopping for the rest of the office and wanted to buy more stuff. And, as it turns out, she's like, why don't we just go to dinner and, like, talk about the art and comics or whatever? There's a little Word Balloon plug in here. I thought that was pretty funny as well. Word Balloon podcast. And, he's like, yeah, I guess we could do dinner. You know, like, you spend a few grand on my art. Why not? And, while they're at dinner, they're talking and she gets a phone call and disappears. And he's on, you know, on the flight back, he's telling one of his other comic creator buddies this whole story. And, the guy's like, unbelievable. Like, you'll never see this woman again. He gets invited to a convention in, I think it was Turkey or somewhere overseas. And it turns out that his chauffeur is this woman. And that's kind of where the book ends. But, really interesting stuff. He's of course got some personal issues as well, which Bendis always throws in, this whole thing. His dad shows up in the book and the dad seems to be just like out on his luck. Like, I don't know if he's on drugs or drunk or whatever, but, he's always asking him for money and he's like, yeah, whatever, dad, I love you. Here's some money. I thought that was kind of nice as well, but really interesting stuff on Uncover. I think the thing about all these Murder Inc., Jinx World books, aside from Murder Inc., which I'll talk about next, they all very much feel like the first issue was not enough for me, where they could have been a lot more. And Murder Inc., I think, is different. So United States versus Murder Inc., number one, is written by Brian Michael Bendis with art by Michael Evan Imming, colors by Taki Soma, and letters by Carlos Mangual. And when I read the synopsis for this last week on the Comic Predictor, it made it seem like the story would be much further along than it actually is. Because in the synopsis and the solicits of the book, they actually talk about how there's these criminal families who've kind of almost seceded from the United States and kind of created their own country, and they're at war with the United States. And I don't get that feeling at all from this issue. In fact, this issue reads very much like a, not stereotypical, but a more typical mob story. So there's a girl who her father, she's doing show and tell, I think, at her school. And she starts telling the story of how her dad was this guy. He was an assassin and he got thrown off a skyscraper and died. And it's just like, oh my God, like, did that really happen? She's like, yeah, like that really happened. She's like, oh, I'm sorry to hear that. Was it a long time ago? She's like, well, if Monday's a long time ago. So, you know, one of those things, right? Like, kids don't really, you know, kids say the darnest things, right? Wasn't that a TV show or something? Kids say the darnest things. And you can kind of tell that from here. But you do get a progression of her character. Her uncle picks her up from school. She's like, look, like, you know, we've been in this business a long time. I'm in the business. Your dad was in the business. Our dad was in the business. Like, we've been kind of the muscle for the mob for many generations. And I kind of want to train you to be in this. You know, I want you to do something, and if you don't feel comfortable, then, you know, you don't need to do it. But this is kind of how we know if you're ready for this business. And it turns out that they actually got the guy that killed her dad, and they had him strapped down in a warehouse with a bunch of guys around them. And he's like, you know, if you feel like you need to take out your anger or whatever, she just grabs a knife and stabs a dude in the eye. And I mean, she's like 6 or 7, right? And the uncle's like, okay, like, you can stop now, because she's tries to keep on stabbing the guy. And we learn that, you know, she is going to be part of this Murder Inc. family. And, you know, you get a few, some time passes by and you learn a little bit more about their relationship and how the uncle's training her to be a marksman and a sniper. He takes her on her first kill and, she's like, well, you know, I could have done it better by doing this. And he's like, okay, good. Like, you just learn from that mistake. So next time you're a more proficient killer. And then you fast forward a little bit more in time and, you know, she's the first mob hitman that's a woman. And that's kind of a big deal, right? So her uncle's been really careful about what jobs she helps him with, how to train her properly, because he feels like the mob guys aren't going to be accepting of a woman being a hitman. And that's understandable, right? And there is a lot of that. We do know that Bendis does some really good, strong female characters. That's one thing that I really love about him. You know, you often hear like, oh, what does the white guy know about writing a black character? Well, you know, here you have Bendis, and he writes many characters of different ethnicities, right? Like Scarlet, for example, that came out a couple weeks ago, she's at least part Asian American, part Chinese, actually. So, and you know, all of his really great characters, I would say, are female characters. He did such a good job at it. So I don't ever want to hear the, oh, well, this person can't do this because they're not blah, blah, blah. That's just BS. Anyways, so he's been training her really carefully because he wants to make sure that they accept her into the family. And it seems like they're going to. So he takes her to meet the Padrino, the godfather of the mob. And she's about to become a made man, or I guess made woman. And, you know, they had to put him through these trials. And, you know, he's like, do you understand what we're about to do? And she's like, yes, Padrino, I understand. He's like, okay, well, before we can continue and bring you into the family, you're going to go through one final trial. He's like, every member that comes in and joins the club has to go through these trials, and you're going to do one. And her trial is to fight this dude who is literally three times her size. Even the uncle's like, oh my God, like, this is kind of a setup, right? Cause he's three times her size. But that's kind of the thing, right? Like, in order to prove yourself, you need to go through these different tests. And her test is going to be bigger than the rest because they technically don't really want her there, right? But presumably she'll pass the test. So I thought it was actually really, really brilliant. And a lot of times I'm not a big fan of, Michael Emmings' art, but it worked really well for this book. It's not quite the, crime noir thing that I would expect in this kind of story, but it works really well because it's colorful, but a lot of it is very dark, dark environments. And the cartoonier style, I think, works pretty well, to kind of elaborate on the atmosphere of the book, right? Because a lot of it is dark. It's about murder. It's about mob life, and that's not really funny stuff, right? And that's kind of, you would see funny stuff on with a cartoony art style. It's not that at all. And I think that's why it works well, because there's quite a bit of jokes in here. But the fact that you have these cartoony looking characters just murdering people left and right, and very graphically, by the way, in many, many cases, I think it works really well. So I really enjoyed it. I'm going to make actually United States versus Murder Inc. my pick of the week. I really enjoyed it. I hope you check it out. And I'm definitely looking forward to the next one. I think right now, this may be my favorite of all the Jinx World books. I did go out and pick up Scarlet 1 through 10. I know I talked about that book last week, I think it was, where I was a little lost as to what was going on. And so in order to not be lost and become found, I went out and picked up the book. So I'm going to read them hopefully this week at some point when I'm on bed rest. And maybe I'll talk about it at some point in the next few weeks. All right, that's going to be it for the top of the pile. Let's do the comic predictor segment, in which I will recommend some books for this week's New Comic Book Day. And first up, I have to talk about a Warren Ellis book. And no, it's not The Wildstorm. Relax. It is Cemetery Beach from Image Comics. First issue is coming out this week. It is written by Warren Ellis with art by Jason Howard. And it says here, from the creators of the acclaimed Trees graphic novels, which, by the way, I love. If you've never read Trees, check it out. It's definitely a slow burn, but very Ellis. And you know me, I love me some Ellis. So if you're an Ellis fan and you haven't read it, shame on you. A professional pathfinder, his only ally, a disinfected young murderess, breaks out of a torture cell in pursuit of his extraction scenario ever. Escaping afoot across a sprawling and secret off-world colony established 100 years ago and filled with generations of lunatics. So this should be pretty fun. It's going to be, I don't even know what to compare this to. The Fugitive, but in space? Oh my God, The Fugitive in space! All right, I'm sold. Everybody knows that anything in space is always better. Cemetery Beach number 1 from Image Comics. I'm really looking forward to that one. Next one, I don't even know how to pronounce it. So I am pronouncing this 1975. Now, whether it's actually 1975, I don't know. It's MCMLXXV number 1. And because of the way it's spelled, I don't know if it's supposed to be actual Roman numerals or not. Because it's capital M, lowercase c, capital M, lowercase LXXV. Anyways, because of number of numerals, I'm going to assume 1975. That's what I'm going to call this book. Because otherwise, saying all those letters is just impossible. This is written by Joe Casey, whom I love. I'm super happy that Joe Casey's writing a book. I don't know what he's been doing. I also haven't checked, so maybe he's been working the whole time. But I do love Joe Casey, so I'm really happy that he's back writing a book. The art is Ian McEwen. This is another Image comic. And this looks really interesting. It's a little supernatural book. It says, meet Pamela Evans, much more than a typical Manhattan cab driver. She also happens to be a badass monster fighter who wields an enchanted tire iron. Welcome to the year of her greatest adventure. this sounds pretty cool. I don't know what the hell it's about, but, you know, a cab driver who fights monsters in her off time. I mean, I'm down with that. 1975 from Image Comics. Fantastic Four number 2 is coming out. I mean, I don't need to talk about that, right? Dan Slott, Scotty Young, Issa Rybik, and Sarah Pacelli, of course. This is going to be the next installment. The first issue ended kind of in a cliffhanger with, Reed and Sue showing the world that they're still around because they posted this giant four symbol, in space. We'll see if they actually come back in this issue, if it'll take a couple of more. You know, I said in the first one that I wish that they had just come in that first issue. The more that I thought about it, the more I wish that it kind of takes, three or four before we actually get Reed and Sue back, with the rest of the team, right? I think that'll be a little more interesting. But I really enjoyed the first one, so I'm looking forward to the next one as well. From Titan Comics, Newbery and Hobbs number 1. This is based on a series of steampunk mystery novels by George Mann, who is also writing this comic book. He's doing a comic adaptation of it. And it follows these two people, Newbery and Hobbs, who have to fight these mysteries, and right now it's going to be an infestation of mystical zombies. And you know what? I love mystical zombies, and I really like steampunk stuff. So I'm curious to try this one out. I don't know anything about these novels that George Mann does. He has done comics in the past. He's done Dark Souls. He's written Doctor Who. He wrote the Warhammer 40,000 comics. But I've never read any of those, so I don't know what his writing style is. But I'm really intrigued by this whole thing, so I'll be picking up Newbery and Hobbs from Titan Comics. Over at Aftershock, Moth and Whisper number 1. This is Ted Anderson and Jen Hickman. And this one seems really interesting. I haven't checked my inbox for the review copy of this yet. But it follows a character who is impersonating her parents, and her parents are Moth and Whisper, and they're kind of the greatest escape artists slash burglars in the world, and they've apparently disappeared, and their kid is kind of pretending to be both of them so that the world still believes they're around. Should be pretty interesting. I'm sure there's going to be some stuff in here about I don't know, gender roles and stuff like that is what I assumed from some of the early information that I received in this book. We'll see if that's the case, but I'm really intrigued by Moth and Whisper, so I'll definitely be checking it out. And it's Aftershock. And you know what? I hate to say it, but Aftershock rarely ever does me wrong. So I am very much looking forward to this one. From Ahoy Comics, I've been really excited for this one for a while. In fact, I need to talk to Tom and get him on the podcast. I had talked to him a little while ago. Wrong Earth number 1 from Ahoy Comics, Tom Payer and Jamal Eagle. And this is the comic in which we see a superhero from two different dimensions. And in one dimension, he is a good guy. And in another one, he's the world's greatest villain. And there's an event that happens, and they get switched between realities, so now the villain is in our Earth, and the superhero is in the other Earth, and that should prove pretty interesting. I know that Ahoy is kind of going a little bit of the comedic route, and I generally don't like comedy in my books, but this one looks really intriguing, so I'm definitely picking up Wrong Earth from Ahoy Comics. Lode Road West, number 1. This is a 5-issue miniseries from Boom Comics, written by Philip Kennedy Johnson with art by Flaviano. And it starts a group of teenagers who are kind of sent out west after a nuclear holocaust strikes the East Coast. And they're going through the country trying to get to the Oklahoma Dust Bowl. And hilarity ensues. And by hilarity, I mean not really good stuff. So I'm excited for this one as well. It, just for the simple fact that it gave me a 100 vibe. And, I don't think I've ever talked about that on the show. Maybe I have. I talk about that show all the time. The 100 is one of my favorite TV shows, that it's out right now. It's a CW show, but it's really, really good. And, it takes place in the future. It's kind of a post-apocalyptic, what happens after a nuclear holocaust on Earth. And people go into space, and they come back. And anyways, go watch it if you haven't. It's great. Lode Road West, number 1 from Boom Studios. And finally, House of Whispers, number 1. This is from DC Vertigo, and this is one of the other books in the Sandman universe. House of Whispers, the one that I've been the most excited about because it's, number 1, all brand-new characters. Number two, it deals heavily with voodoo magic, and I have a weird fascination with like New Orleans voodoo stuff. I think that whole mythology is really interesting, an interesting blend of, you know, African folklore and Christian beliefs and stuff like that. It's really interesting. Anyways, House of Whisper number one from, Nayla Hopkinson, Dominique, and Sean Andrew Murray. I'm very excited for this one, so I'll be picking this one up as well. That is going to wrap up this episode of Comic Talk Today. Thank you all for listening, and to all the new people, I should have said at the beginning, welcome. Welcome. We got like 1,000 new listeners last week. So, I don't know if any of you are sticking around. Maybe some of you just came in for the, Dinesh interview. But, if you stick around, then, thank you for doing so. Be sure to leave an iTunes review if you can. You can, of course, find me on Twitter at Geekvine. You can email the show nerdylegion@gmail.com. I announced this on Twitter the other day. We have a new podcast coming to the network, The Bat Pod, with Bill Beer, who was my guest on the show a few weeks ago. He's going to be doing a Batman-centric podcast. I'll be showing up every probably few weeks on that show. I don't have a whole lot of time, but every few weeks I'll be on there. Some of you may remember I used to do a Batman show called I Am Gotham, in which I did Golden Age Batman stuff. I'll be popping in and out of that podcast, talking about that stuff in there. So it'll be kind of a return of I Am Gotham, but not really, because it's not my podcast. It's Bill Podcast. So go follow them on Twitter. I think it's at Bat Podcast or Bat Pod, and Bill is at Gotham Knight 13. That's going to be it. I'll be back tomorrow with the news. I'll catch you then.